NPR News. You're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, the future of legalized marijuana. Two states say it's okay to buy pot, and two more are putting the idea to voters.
It's pretty interesting and really liberating to go into a store and purchase marijuana legally.
And an Iraqi doctor and an American colonel reunite in Michigan after his son's death.
Weighing heavy on my heart was a feeling of guilt and responsibility.
Then an author's self-discovery about race and family.
My initial intention was to go there and make people's heads explode with the news that they were black.
And Martha Wainwright's Come Home to Mama, a tribute to her late mother.
Come home to mama.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Let's start our cover story today with a guy named William.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, William. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
He lives in Denver.
Hi, I'm William Breeze. I'm a reporter with the Denver Westward here. I cover medical marijuana, and I review medical marijuana dispensaries much like a restaurant critic.
A professional marijuana critic. And no, that's not his real name. Like any good critic, he has to stay anonymous. William Breeze is his pseudonym.
Well, it's a reference to a song by a band.
Fish.
Yes, exactly. So
we got it.
You got it.
Above the trees where Billy breathes, we float above.
Anyway, William says a day after the election, when the state passed an amendment to legalize marijuana, Coloradans were already expecting to walk into a head shop and purchase a joint.
Yeah, I was in a shop, and it was the day after the amendment had passed here. And the shop owners were getting calls left and right from people asking if they could just come in and buy marijuana legally. And then at one point, someone had walked in the store and sort of handed their ID over to the woman and was expected to be let back into the back. So he wasn't, and I found the whole thing kind of funny. People are just expecting to be able to walk into these medical stores and buy marijuana right away.
That's because right now, only people like William, who has a state-issued medical marijuana card for treatment of chronic stomach pain, can buy marijuana legally. But within a year, the state is expected to have a regulatory framework up and running for what's expected to be a pot boom in the Mile High State. What will that look like? And how will the government handle states with laws that don't square with federal regulations? We're asking those questions because now that Colorado and Washington State have legalized marijuana, Rhode Island and Maine are putting it on the ballot in 2013. Other states may follow. And not long after, mass commercialization, with cigarette companies getting in on the act, even stores that sell THC-infused food of all kinds. Any THC turkeys that were consumed out there this week?
I imagine someone has found a way to infuse their gravy, yes. I have not been privy to any, but if anyone knows of any, send me an email.
Legalization is actually part of a trend line that goes all the way back to the 1970s. That's according to Peter Bourne, who ran the U.S. Office of Drug Abuse Policy for President Jimmy Carter. He was essentially the nation's first drug czar, and Bourne says that back then, it looked like the country was on a fast track towards more relaxed marijuana laws.
Well, the administration's position basically was that the penalties for marijuana use did infinitely more damage to people and their lives than the drug did. And in the White House, our position was that under federal law, there should be only a civil penalty for having up to 1 ounce of marijuana. We also felt it should be left up to the individual states to decide how they wish to handle it, and they shouldn't be dictated to by the federal government.
There were ads on television for legalization, if I remember rightly.
There were indeed, yes.
The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws suggests that you write to the president and thank him for his commitment to a more just marijuana policy in this country. His address is the White House.
Did you think at the time that the legalization of marijuana was inevitable?
Yes, I did think that then. There's, you know, the contrast and still the prevailing view was the one which came in with the Reagan administration.
Leading medical researchers are coming to the conclusion that marijuana, pot, grass, whatever you want to call it, is probably the most dangerous drug in the United States, and we haven't begun to find
out. You know, we have the absurd nonsense from Nancy Reagan about just say no, you know, which is, to me, equivalent to telling somebody who's depressed to have a nice day. So even though we sent a bill to Congress to decriminalize the federal law for amounts of less than an ounce, never passed the Congress.
But President Carter wasn't the only one with an eye towards relaxed rules on marijuana. In one of the better-kept secrets of the story about marijuana in the 70s, Peter Bourne says big tobacco companies were poised to get in on the act, too.
I mean, I was in fairly regular discussion with the tobacco people, and they very clearly had contingency plans that they'd developed to grow and market marijuana should it be legalized.
We wanted to know more about that, what it could reveal about future plans for commercialization. So I spoke to Tony DeCopel. He's a reporter for the Daily Beast and Newsweek. He wrote a recent story on the changing legal status of marijuana.
There were high-level conversations about adding marijuana to tobacco, creating a line of marijuana cigarettes, and being ready to jump in and market this. And then there were some other interesting cases, too. In 1993, in France, when that country was approaching legalization, there was a strong push to legalize marijuana. Philip Morris, coincidentally or not so coincidentally, they trademarked Marley brand.
As in Bob Marley.
Well, you know, Bob Marley estate said, obviously, you mean Bob Marley, and we don't like that you're doing this, and they sued. And Philip Morris said, no, we mean any kind of Marley. We're just saying Marley. It could be Jacob Marley. And everyone was like, who? Jacob?
Oh, no. Come on. Jacob. Ebenezer.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's an obscure Dickens character, you know, who's mean and cheap and doesn't smoke and doesn't drink. And this is not somebody who you would want to market your smokable items. I mean, that was the other telling thing, is that the trademark request, it didn't specify what was being smoked. It just said smokable consumer products.
Marijuana, by the way, is still not legal in France. But Colorado's been growing it out in the open for years. Well, inside. Tony DeCopel visited a grow house there.
Colorado has more than 1 million square feet of warehouse dedicated or leased to medical marijuana growers. And you go into these warehouses and it looks like a normal warehouse. Like there might be Coca-Cola being stored there or it might be servicing a grocery store. And then you go into these smaller rooms within rooms and that's where the plants are. And it's magical. Your eyes recognize sunlight. It's the glow lamps. And the plants are waving gently at you because they're being stirred by fans. And there's classical music playing or there's rock and roll playing depending on what the grower says the plant likes. And then there'll be people walking among the plants, the bud tenders. And I refer to them as the Keebler elves of cannabis because they really live and breathe and sleep among the plants and they tend to them beautifully.
So now, for the moment, what you're describing is used in the service of legal medical marijuana?
That's right. Colorado is already a revolutionary state in this regard. It has a for-profit medical marijuana market. The 17 other states that have medical marijuana have cooperatives or nonprofit models. So it's already big business marijuana in Colorado. There's a very concerted effort to control where the pot comes from, who's getting it, and also to make some money. I mean, to make this a market that business people would be interested in being part of.
But marijuana is still considered illegal by the federal government. So how would it work? There would have to be some kind of federal oversight role, no?
It's an outstanding question, and no one knows the answer yet. The Justice Department has said it's reviewing the situation, and that review has no end date. A decision will have to be made. Guidance will have to be given to federal attorneys in those two states about whether or not they should prosecute cases of legal marijuana.
Well, Tony, I want to talk about the pros and the cons of legalization. First of all, are you advocating that it be legal?
Well, when I look at the different options, I come down on the side of legalizing marijuana, but in a tightly restricted way. So I really like the Colorado regulatory model. There's a ban on advertising. There are cameras that track the marijuana from bloom to end consumer. So the diversion into the black market is limited. There are extensive background checks on the people who are part of the marketplace. So you're not a front for the black market. You're not a former black market dealer. You're not a member of a Mexican cartel. Most likely. I don't think such an open model like the alcohol model would be good for marijuana. And I think most Americans at this point come down on that side as well. They don't want to be driving down the highway and see advertisements for Budweiser and then also, you know, Bud. they don't want to have to move their kids away from the marijuana rack at the bodega or the grocery store in their neighborhood. So I think tight controls is where the people who favor legalization come down.
So Tony DeCoppel, where do you see Colorado's marijuana business in 5 years' time? Will it be like going to Starbucks?
Assuming the federal government does not intervene, I think you will have a variety of products at different levels of intensity, exactly like Starbucks. That's a really good comparison, right? Because you go to Starbucks, you can get an espresso, you can get a long, you can get a coffee, you can get snacks, you know, they're edibles. You might be able to walk in there, and in the case, they'll have, you know, 12 different strains of cannabis, sativa, indica, you know, purple kush, green crack, I mean, whatever colorful name is popular at the moment. And then behind the counter, there might be hash, there might be in another container, edibles, like fizzy drinks or brownies. There could be a hot dog wheel turning. I mean, you can put THC in anything. So anything could be edible with marijuana. And the model, that's an excellent comparison. I think that's what you'll see.
Tony DeCoppel, reporter for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He's working on a book about all this. By the way, William Breathes, that professional marijuana critic from Denver, he thinks marijuana tourism in Colorado could soon be no more unusual than, say, a fly fishing trip to the state.
Around the country, I get a lot of emails from people really excited about this and saying they're looking forward to visiting Colorado now. And I agree. Having a joint and fly fishing are actually two very wonderful things together.
So, there you have it. Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. For years, I followed the fortunes and misfortunes of an Iraqi family I met in Baghdad in 2003, the family of Dr. Najib Hanoudi. From the start of the war, Dr. Hanoudi, an Oxford-trained Christian ophthalmologist, supported the American invasion and the toppling of Saddam. In April of 2003, on his street in the upscale neighborhood of Mansour, he met an American patrol from the 2nd Brigade 3rd ID. The battalion was called the Desert Rogues.
They called themselves the Rogues or the Rogues or something like that, but they were never rogues. They were very polite, very civilized, and very helpful and very keen on the job which they were doing.
He offered some information to the commander of the Rogues, Colonel Eric Schwartz. There was a weapons cache in the neighborhood belonging to the regime, and so began a deep and ultimately unbreakable relationship. Recently, Colonel Schwartz drove from his home in Pennsylvania to reunite with Najib Hanoudi outside Detroit. They began by looking at some old photos.
I have your picture when you were coming from Kuwait, when you were caught in that huge brown storm.
Colonel Schwartz remembers what drew him to Najib Hanoudi, even though it's hard to trust a stranger while patrolling in Iraq.
There's this instinct you have, not only as a commander and as a soldier, but just as a man and as a father, that when you meet someone that you trust, it's hard to fight it. He said, well, can we sit around and talk? We sat around the table. We drank some chai tea, which was always the direction to my heart. If you poured a cup of tea, I was always ready to sit and talk. We talked in great detail about the political situation, geography, religion. I learned right at that moment that he was a jewel. He was a national treasure, that he understood so much that we never took the time to learn.
Eric Schwartz was keenly aware that he and his troops were culturally ignorant and that that was a liability. And that's where Najib Hanoudi would prove to be an invaluable asset.
I had an ace in the hole. He's a master teacher. And I would go to him with our plans and I would ask him to provide the cultural aspect of the mission. Najib, does this make sense? He would shrug his shoulders and he would say, my kind sir, which essentially meant, I wouldn't do it that way. I would consider that you do it this way, or perhaps a better approach is this.
Dr. Hanoudi vividly recalls those early days of the invasion.
When the Americans came and got us rid of Saddam, I was very happy. And I was with my grandson clapping and jumping and dancing in the street and throwing roses to the Americans. It was amazing.
But the optimism and jubilation of the war's early days didn't last. The next year, in 2004, Dr. Hanouti's world fell apart. His son Nazar was working as a contractor on an American military base. One day, he arrived at work using an unfamiliar entrance. The U.S. soldier on duty mistook him for an intruder and shot him. Though American doctors in Baghdad tried to treat Nazar, a week later, an Iraqi ambulance transporting him ran out of oxygen. He was left in a vegetative state. It took the Hanoutis 3 more years to come to America with Nazar. They came to Michigan seeking treatment for him, but Nazar died just before Christmas last year in a nursing home. In all the exhausting intervening years, Dr. Hanouti and his wife and other son rarely left Nazar's side.
There are cases in the literature which have recovered. And all the time, we were hoping that he would be with good care, with the best possible nursing assistance, he would recover. But I always believed that the expected reversal would only happen as a physician, as a scientist, you see myself, that we need some kind of a miracle. I knew that miracle happened. There is a big power up there. But there was no miracle. In the end, there was actually no miracle. And the story ended a few days before Christmas. And 2 days later, we laid him. We laid him to rest in a cemetery here in Michigan.
The long, lingering death of Nazar Hanouti is also difficult for Colonel Schwartz to bear.
Weighing heavy on my heart was a feeling of guilt and responsibility, because ultimately we chose the Hanoutis. We chose to ask for Nazar's help and assistance in our stabilization of a future for Baghdad. He graciously volunteered to assist us. When we departed, Nazar in turn went and worked for another army unit, another army team, who ultimately killed him. So many of us have tremendous weight on our heart that if we hadn't involved ourselves in that day, things would have turned out a lot different.
But Najib Hanouti doesn't agonize over the what-ifs or feelings of resentment.
I'm not bitter. I'm not even bitter about the boy, the young boy who shot him, you see, because I would never hope that any father would be in a position like that. But I am sad about it.
And Dr. Hanouti's feelings about the war itself?
I have came to the conclusion that it was either a very bad mistake as a result of some stupidity and not understanding the place they were going into, the planners, not the people who affected the change, who helped us get rid of Saddam, to whom I'm still feel a great debt, or it was some very cynical, you know, bad, terrible agenda by some terrible force.
We'll never have closure. We'll never complete this puzzle, but this is a time for us all to just come together as brothers and as family, more than friends. This is truly a family that was built starting the 11th of April.
Dr. Hanouti's working on a book about what this last decade has meant to him and his family. And it isn't ultimately about the grimmest days of the war, but about what has sustained him in this last chapter of his life.
I have a motto. I have something which I go by. I always said and believe very strongly that a life which is worth living is a life which is lived for the others. And I think that I share some of my life with these people, you see.
His military brothers will be there for him next year when Dr. Najib Hanouti, now 78, and his wife, Firyal, complete the journey begun on a Baghdad street in 2003 and become American citizens. Growing up blonde and blue-eyed in Southern California, Joe Mazzingo thought his name was Italian, but the family history on his father's side had always been a bit of a mystery. On the journey to discover the truth about the Mazzingo name, Joe travels from the libraries of Los Angeles to the courthouses and plantations of Virginia, and finally to Angola. Along the way, he learns about 300 years of Mazzingos, from abolitionists to members of the KKK. Joe Mazzingo joined us from NPR West to tell us how the journey began and the book he's written about it called The Fiddler on Pantico Run.
I always had kind of a longing to understand the history of the place I lived in, and I think that came from the fact that I had no family history that I knew of. And then when people started asking me my name, as you mentioned, I kept wondering, how is it that we don't actually know where this name came from?
So it's somewhere around the time that you go to journalism school that you make a connection, sort of your aha moment, if you will.
And I met a professor who was Sherry Mazzingo, and she was black. And she had done a lot more research than I had on her genealogy and had been to a family reunion in North Carolina and came back with news that the name was African and that we all descended from the same person. And he was, in her words, a Bantu warrior. My uncle, out of nowhere, said we did in fact come from Virginia, where this slave had landed. There was this period in Virginia that I'd never known about where free blacks and poor whites were mixing and getting married even.
So let's go back to this ancestor whose name is Edward Mazzingo. He's abducted from, you think at the time, Cameroon. Later on, you think Angola. He's only a child. And tell us what happens.
We think he landed in when he was about 11 years old near Jamestown. And basically when these Africans arrived, they figured they wouldn't live more than a couple of years. There was no reason to have a lifelong slave, so they treated them as indentured servants. So Edward appears to have had a contract with his master to work a certain amount of time.
This is fascinating. You are actually able to trace Edward Mazzingo's freedom papers, if you will, to 1672 in Virginia.
It's a complete miracle that that paper survived. The records surrounding it were burned in the courthouse in Williamsburg, and then they were trucked to a courthouse in Richmond, which burned during the Civil War. His volume just happened to be gone the day that the Richmond courthouse burned, but was lost, presumably for good, until it turned up in the Virginia Historical Society in a pile of mutilated, tattered documents. But there it was, this one intact page with his ruling.
He turns up at the courthouse in Jamestown. I think it's October the 5th, 1672.
Yeah. And I went to that courthouse and saw the exact spot he would have walked out when he got his freedom, looking up the James River as it kind of winds up into America. I mean, it's a beautiful spot.
And then he seems to have become relatively prosperous for the day. He's a tradesman. He marries a white woman.
He marries a white woman who doesn't even seem to be particularly poor, even.
You stumble across many people with the name Mazzingo in this book. And there in Virginia, you meet a character, Junior Mazzingo. A lot of these people didn't really want to think about having an African ancestor.
He didn't want to hear about it at all. I mean, he had lived literally on the spot where Edward Mazzingo had lived 300 years before, yet he had this myth that they were Italian and they had gotten here in the 1800s, when in fact you could trace his lineage straight to Edward. Edward is his seventh great-grandfather.
And you handled that in a pretty gingerly way.
I did. My initial intention was to go there and make people's heads explode with the news that they were black, even though they weren't. But, you know, someone invites you into their house, they're very nice, and you realize this guy lived a very hard life.
When does the line sort of bend? When is his family crossing the color line?
There was this brief period where Edward did well, and then the rich classes really wanted to put the squeeze on the poor to create the system of slavery, which really marginalized the poor whites and the free people of color. Their fates went downhill really fast. They were suddenly out of money. One of them re-indentured himself to, you know, pay off some debt. They basically started leaving the area, and that was the time they could reinvent themselves. Those that were light-skinned enough could say they were white. And wherever they landed, they came up with a new myth. You know, people said they were French Huguenot, Portuguese.
Anything but African.
Anything but African, exactly.
In the second half of this book, you actually decide that you must go to Africa, and you meet another Mazingo, and his name is Victor Masinga, and he's a very famous playwright. What does he tell you?
He starts telling me a story, how his grandfather landed in jail. The day he got out of jail, his son was born, and they named his son Masinga. And he said that Masinga is a thread or a linking of people, which just blew my mind because that was what I was trying to do with this whole book, draw this link from Edward Masinga in Africa all the way across the Atlantic to me in California and just through the people along the way.
Yeah, I kind of got chills when I saw that. The closing scene of your book, you're at your cousin's wedding in Virginia Beach. She's a white woman. She's marrying a black man. And it's a bit heartbreaking. Her father refuses to attend because it's an interracial marriage.
It's hard to believe that people can't get past these things. You know, when her grandfather came up to me when I first met him, went on and on about how she was his favorite granddaughter, how much he loved her, how proud of her he was. And when he found this out, he just went ballistic and fell into a deep depression and subsequently had a lot of health problems.
I gather that branch of your family hasn't been coming to book readings.
No. Well, some of them have. I mean, she who got married, I mean, we're friends.
That's Joe Masinga. His new book out is called The Fiddler on Pantico Run. Joe, thank you so much. It's really fascinating.
Thank you.
Mary Alice LeGros is a professional party princess. She graduated from the Savannah College of Art and Design in 2003. She's the author of a dark fantasy graphic novel series, Bizengast, which had 8 volumes between 2005 and 2011. It got lots of positive press. Since the recession, though, she's had a hard time getting more work in her field, and so she funds her creative pursuits through Kickstarter. She turned her love of cosplay into a job as a professional party princess, and she blogs and illustrates her life. I just want to say, Princess Marty, it is a great pleasure to have you with us.
It's unbelievable to sit here and talk to somebody who's talked to a real princess, Princess Di, as well as many other very influential people.
I just got to shake her hands, but I can tell you she did have violet eyes. Yes, it was at a garden party in London many years ago. May I describe what you are wearing?
Go right ahead.
Well, you have alighted here in full regalia. You have a gorgeous golden gown on, opera length gloves, of course, and a tiara, as all princesses must have. How's the princess game, Princess Marty? How's it going?
It just gets exponentially more profitable and more exciting as we go from year to year. 10 years ago, you wouldn't have even heard about this job. And now here we are. People are talking about it on the radio.
What is the most important thing a princess has to do?
Smile and be in character all the time. You can never ruin it for a child, even if you're coming home from work and you're standing on the corner, as I've often done, waiting for the light to change so you can cross and you're in your big dress. If a child sees you, you have to be a princess for them. You can't say, sorry, kid, I'm off the clock.
Do princesses have a little princessy voice?
We do. We have a princessy voice.
So can you speak to me in that?
Well, hello, children. It's so wonderful to be here in your third birthday, Jackie.
You know, I never really got over my third birthday. However, we thought we would ask some real 3-year-olds and kids maybe a tiny bit older than that if they could name any princesses. And here's what we got. Would you mind putting on your headphones around that tiara?
Absolutely.
Cinderella, Jasmine, Snow White, Ariel.
Princess Belle and Princess Ariel and Princess Sleeping Beauty and Aurora, Mulan, Tatiana, and Cinderella.
Wow. Are any of them familiar to you?
Yes, she forgot one. Pocahontas.
Oh.
Yes, I know them all as well.
You know, the princess in our culture doesn't always have a great connotation as we get older.
No, it's actually one of the number one questions I get is, do you ever get people who feel like it's very anti-feminist? And I say, have you talked to any children lately who like princesses? The number one thing I hear from them when I say, oh, what would you do if you were a princess? And they say,
I would be in charge.
For them, it's more about being in charge, eating cookies all day long. They like the pretty dresses, but they also like the idea of being the most important person in the kingdom.
As you want to be on your fourth or fifth or third birthday.
I think anybody at any birthday would like to be the master of their own destiny.
So we had a writer, Princess Marty, on NPR a few months back named Peggy Orenstein, and she wrote a book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. And in that book, she says this whole princess culture could actually be really hurtful to a girl's self-esteem. And I would imagine you've thought about that.
I believe that without fostering a general sense of play and creativity in your child and simply dumping this princess culture in all its merchandising form onto children, you can do damage to them. And I think you should encourage kids to explore their creativity at a young age in a very gender-neutral way. Do things that aren't just princessy or aren't just G.I. Joe and that sort of thing.
And are there ever little boys at any of these parties?
There are. I did a party last weekend where the little brother was there, and he was just as excited, if not more so, to see the princess. The mother actually bought him a tutu in case he wanted to dress up, because all the other children were in costume, and he was contemplating it, because he was jealous.
Alice LeGros is a professional party princess and the author of the graphic novel series called Bizengast. She visited our studios in D.C. in full princess regalia, no less. And if you want to see Princess Marty in action, check out the video we have online at npr.org. Princess Marty, it has been a great pleasure. I don't want you to go poof and make you go away, so I'm just going to say thank you.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
As families gather together this holiday weekend, we bring you the story of what some believe was a father's sacrifice for his daughter, and others, a calculated political statement. Dr. Norman Cansfield is a respected pastor, scholar, and a lifelong member of the Reformed Church in America. In 2004, Cansfield officiated at the same-sex marriage of his daughter, Anne, and her partner, Jen. The official doctrine of the Reformed Church doesn't allow for same-sex marriage. The following year, the church held a trial and found Cansfield guilty of breaking church doctrine. He was removed from his position as seminary president and no longer allowed to pastor or teach. NPR's Lily Percy has this story.
In the study room of their home in eastern Pennsylvania's countryside, Norman Cansfield sings softly while his wife Mary follows along on the piano. The hymn is called In Every Age God Calls and Shapes the Church, and Cansfield wrote it for his daughter Anne's ordination last year. Neither thought they would ever see Anne ordained. Anne was ordained by the more liberal United Church of Christ, even though, like her father, she's a member of the Reformed Church in America, a Protestant denomination that was founded in the early 1600s by Dutch immigrants. But unlike her dad, Anne could never be ordained in the Reformed Church because she's a lesbian. Cansfield remembers when Anne came out to him.
Well, Anne told me in the car while I was driving on the New Jersey Turnpike, so I had to keep at least one eye on the road. But I assured her that that didn't change anything. We loved her and we would always love her.
In 2004, after Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage, Anne and her longtime girlfriend, Jennifer, decided they wanted to get married, and Anne asked her father if he would perform the ceremony. Cansfield agreed and informed the New Brunswick Theological Seminary in New Jersey, where he served as president, of his plans.
I had thought there would be a request for my resignation, and nobody did that.
So that June, at the church in Northampton, Massachusetts, where theologian Jonathan Edwards first experienced his Great Awakening, Cansfield officiated Anne and Jen's marriage.
I'm a very emotional person, so I was quite pleased that I had not choked up or teared up throughout the service, worked very hard at that. And then afterward, two women came to me and said that that was the first service in which they had genuinely felt a part of church in years. They were a lesbian couple, and at that point, I wept.
After the wedding, things stayed quiet for a while, but Cansfield's contract with the seminary was set to expire the next year, and when the board met in January of 2005, they decided not to renew his contract.
You know, up to that point, it had kind of been don't ask, don't tell.
That's Wesley Granberg Michelson. He served as general secretary of the Reformed Church for 17 years before retiring in 2011. As general secretary, Granberg Michelson was the church's spokesperson, but he also happened to be Cansfield's friend. The pair had met back in their early days at seminary. He believes that Cansfield left the church no other option but to discipline him.
It was clear that while this certainly was a father's love for his daughter, it also was a intentional statement that Norm was trying to make.
You see, Cansfield wasn't only a pastor or a seminary president. He was also a professor of theology, an elected position that only about a dozen members within the church hold.
And Norm, as one whose responsibility was to be a teacher of the church, and as one who was the leader of one of our seminaries, took an action directly contrary to the vows he had made to uphold.
So that June, for the first time in the church's history, they held a trial to judge Norman Cansfield.
Both parties didn't feel like they needed to back down from a confrontation, and so it was very hard to figure out a mediated compromise that would prevent that. And at the end of the day, we couldn't.
The Reformed Church in America found Cansfield guilty of violating church law. Although Cansfield was not excommunicated, his right to teach and pastor within the denomination was taken away.
It's really a wonderful thing to know that your parents love you so much and are willing to go and make such sacrifices for me. But it isn't just a sacrifice for me. It was a sacrifice for all LGBT people and for the church itself.
That's Cansfield's daughter, Anne.
And I'm proud of being able to say, hey, not all Christians think the same thing. And here's actual proof.
Anne says that her father's trial has changed the Reformed Church. Before Norman Cansfield's trial, the Reformed Church was one of a handful of Protestant churches that didn't have an LGBT advocacy group. But now there is one, a group called Room for All. And gay-affirming pastors within the church have become more outspoken.
I mean, I could have counted on my hand the number of out gay people I knew in the denomination and of people who supported out gay people. That changed radically.
In an interesting twist of fate, Anne hasn't left the Reformed Church in America. In fact, she leads one of their congregations in Brooklyn.
And if you would have asked me 9 years ago before I started here if I would have ever gotten a job in the Reformed Church in America, I would have said no. Like, there's no possible way.
Anne has a contract with Greenpoint Reformed Church, but she's not officially their pastor. They would have to seek approval from the denomination to install her permanently, and as of right now, 9 years later, they haven't chosen to do so. Late last year, Norman Cansfield issued an apology to the Reformed Church and was reinstated as a pastor. Although he says he's forbidden from sharing the details of that apology, he does say that his views on LGBT rights have not changed.
I'm very convinced that there is nothing in Scripture which speaks against the kinds of dedicated same-sex relationships that people are struggling to have in our day and age. Paul didn't know anything like that. That's not what Paul was writing against. That's not what Leviticus was writing against.
When I ask Cansfield if he ever regrets performing his daughter's wedding ceremony, he doesn't hesitate before answering.
It felt absolutely right to do it. It felt right before the wedding. It felt right during the wedding. It felt right after the wedding. It felt right in the trial and after the trial.
Lily Percy, NPR News.
And it's time now for music. That's the voice of the late folk singer Kate McGarrigle. She died in 2010. And the Martha she's referring to in that song is Martha Wainwright, her daughter with fellow folk icon Loudon Wainwright III. Now it's Martha who's telling the story. Martha Wainwright's new album is called Come Home to Mama, and it's mostly inspired by the loss of her mother, Kate, and the birth of her first child, events that happened within 2 months of each other. On this track, All Your Clothes, Martha Wainwright sings directly to Kate McGarrigle.
We've been these days, I thought I saw you underneath the vine.
I think my mother was always worried about me when she was alive. Being the second child and playing music, which was something that everybody in my family did, I think I lacked any real self-confidence about what I was doing. I was a kind of a misfit, and when my mother died, you know, I had to become an adult.
see they've cut your hair and grown between your eyes.
But it feels good. It feels better, you know. My mother was someone who lived her life very fully. Every moment was very magical. And I think that finally, you know, I could say that her passing has sort of woken me up to this world, really.
Can we pretend we're talking? Baby's doing fine. My marriage is failing, but I keep trying all the time.
Do you still talk to your mother?
Not as much as I did at the beginning, certainly. But I try and listen more now. I inherited my mother's house in Montreal when she died, and I asked my aunt, Anna, to find someone to clean it. And she found a cleaning lady in Montreal, and she told me via email that the cleaning lady said that my mother was very angry because we weren't listening to her. So she was a psychic or a medium or something.
Wow.
And
a psychic cleaning lady.
A psychic cleaning lady.
Think about
and
it.
She said, on another note, she's a very good cleaner, though, but Kate is very upset that we have not been listening to her. So I took that as a sign just to sort of try and not be so dogged in my opinions and try and think about what she would have done or how she would have reacted to things and treated people, because she was very good, and I've enjoyed absorbing some of her personality since she's gone.
Speaking of that, let's listen to this song, Proserpina, because this is about a mother and daughter separated and the last song your mother ever wrote, and it's just really, really beautiful. Let's just have a listen for a moment.
I shall punish the earth, I shall turn down the heat, I shall take away every morsel to eat, I shall turn every field into stone, where I walk crying alone, crying for Proserpina.
Before I started making this record, I recorded the song because I wanted to claim it as my own. A few people had heard it when she performed it at the Royal Albert Hall, and I just felt that really it was a gift to me. And when I recorded it just soon after she died, it was really in a state of disbelief, where I thought that if I sang it like her, if I closed my eyes and if I sang it well enough, that maybe when I opened them that she would reappear.
Proserpina, Proserpina, come home to mama, come home to mama, Proserpina.
This is the song on Come Home to Mama where you sound the most like her. I could actually close my eyes and hear her too, as you did. I'm speaking with singer and songwriter Martha Wainwright. Her new album is about the loss of her mother, Kate McGarrigle. It's called Come Home to Mama. You know, there's a song here that I think is written to your son called Everything Wrong.
I don't want you to feel alone, but you probably will when you are alone. I will try to stay alive, to see as much through your eyes, but one day you know I will go.
Your mom and son did meet briefly, yes. At least. She got to hold him.
She got to hold him. There's a couple of photographs. She got to hold him because he was born very early, and the plan was to go home and be with my mother and tend to her because she was very ill already at this point, and to have the child there with her and to have everyone together, and that maybe also this child would save her life. You know, you have these feelings of, well, maybe if the baby comes, that she'll be happy and things will turn around. Yeah. I didn't feel well. I told Brad, let's go to the hospital. And we had the baby within a few hours of with emergency C-section. He was under 3 pounds when he was born. And I called my mother right as we were about to go into the operating room, and I told her what was up. And she was on a plane within 24 hours, very unwell. But they got to meet, and from that point on, she got into bed, and mm-hmm. that was it. Mm-hmm. And she died on January 18th, which was his due date.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Oh, that is a remarkable story. You know, it is the weekend after Thanksgiving, and given everything that we've just talked about here, what are you giving thanks for this time?
Well, I'm giving thanks for my new family. It's very interesting to have gone from essentially a pot-smoking hippie living in a one-room in Williamsburg writing songs to someone now who now is concerned with women's health because of having a preemie and my age at this point, because I'm 36. And, you know, it's just crazy. I don't know what happened. What happened? Where did it go? Maybe I should. I should have probably started earlier. Just not having, maybe having children, but just getting responsible. But it's all coming in now. And
if your mom could hear that note of anxiety and see you embrace the anxiety that so many people face and so many women face, I bet you she'd have some encouraging things to say to you.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. Well, sure. That's what I'm trying to listen for all the time.
And, you know, the psychic cleaning lady told
yes.
you, you have to listen. That's Martha Wainwright. Her latest album is called Come Home to Mama, and you can watch her performing here at NPR as part of our Tiny Desk concert series. Go to nprmusic.org. Martha, really, it's been so grand meeting you. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
For the week ending November 25th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Walter Ray Watson, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Acacia Squires. Our intern is Barbara Sprunt. Their technical director is Daniel Shukin. Mathoni Maturi is the senior editor, and Steve Lichtai, our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. Guy Raz is back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered, Weekends. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.